We're going to open the Senate Education Committee. Today is April 6th, 2017. It's nice to have everybody here today. We're going to try to go through...
I'm with you on that.
Thank you. We're going to try to go through these fairly quickly, so keep your time as close as you can to things. Today is the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entry into World War I. U.S. declared war on Germany this day, back in that date.
I think we're still at war with Germany, aren't we?
Who knows? So with that, we're going to open public hearing. I think we're going to go pretty much the way this is. Or do you want to go to travel? I see Senator Farioli. I see Senator Taylor. She has to go. Are you okay to stay for a few moments? Okay. So we're going to open... public hearing on Senate Bill 887. So, Senator Taylor, come on up.
889.
And 889. We'll open a public hearing on that so you can do both of them at the same time. That would be helpful for us as well.
Okay. Do you mind if we do 889 first?
I have no care which way you go.
Thank you, because I have a constituent here with me. Thank you. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator for District 21. Senate Bill 889 comes to you today on behalf of a constituent of mine, Margaret DeLacy. Margaret is not only a constituent, but also a very bright and tireless advocate for increasing funding for the Talented and Gifted program, as well as ensuring that TAG programs in school districts across our state are effective and useful for the students who have unique education needs. Unfortunately, over the years, these programs have seen a smaller portion of funds allotted to them, and additionally, the requirements for districts to report their compliance with TAG standards have been scaled back, which is of concern to advocates in my district. I will now turn it over to Margaret, and she's going to, she really knows the bill, and she's going to give us some more information. So thank you, Chair Roblin.
Good morning, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Margaret DeLacy. I live in Portland, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted and the thousands of gifted students across Oregon. This bill has two provisions. One is to create a funding study, and I have provided data in your testimony packet that shows you why this has become an issue. TAG funding has fallen both on an absolute and a per capita basis steadily over the decade, as funding per capita for everyday students and other students has steadily increased. So these students are actually going backwards. I'm here mostly to answer your questions, so if you want to discuss that, I'd be happy to. You'll also see from the material I submitted that there are huge differences from one district to another, even among districts that are more or less the same size. And many districts are not reporting spending anything at all on TAG, and it is very unlikely then that they're identifying and serving students in those districts. We believe that if a student is an Oregonian, they should have some right to equity of services around the state. I also wanted to talk to you about the second section of the bill. You may hear testimony later that this bill increases paperwork. That is absolutely not the case. This bill does not increase paperwork, and this bill has no effect whatsoever on mandate relief. The Division 22 standards are administrative rules, are the rules that you, members of the legislature, passed to protect our students' health and safety. The two newest ones have to do with lead in school water, radon, and dyslexia. And the checklist that you are seeing over there is a checklist that districts are required already under state law to submit annually. The only thing that this bill does is it restores the practice which is already enshrined in the Oregon administrative rules that districts must also submit this self-same checklist to the State Department of Education annually. That's what the administrative rule says. We are asking the department to follow its own administrative rules. We believe that if a department decides it doesn't want to follow its administrative rules, then it should go through rulemaking process and not just issue a declaration that it's going to stop following its rules. But whether or not the process was correct, This checklist is submitted annually by every district in the state to their communities, and we do not see why it would be burdensome for them to continue, as they did in the past, to submit it also to the State Department of Education. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Margaret. Ever since I've been in the legislature, I know that we have talked every session about your concerns about this, and I know that you have been here longer than I have been, and I can't imagine how frustrating that is to work so tirelessly and work so hard and have to continue coming back to ask for the same things. And I do hope that we can move forward with the bill, and in that third section, I do think that it is important for those Division 22 standards to be sent in every year. It's not an increase in paperwork, and often that's the only way that we can know whether or not those standards are being met, and it keeps it on the radar. So I know that you and I talked about that in our office. I had hoped to be able to get some resolution on that, and that hasn't happened to this point, but I really wanted to put on the record here that to me that makes sense, and that measure of accountability for all of our students is important. So thanks to the senator for bringing the bill, and thanks to you for not giving up, and also for being another example of Earlham Everywhere.
Chair Roblin, Senator Gelser, thank you very much. I would just like to add that the complaint process is also in these Division 22 standards. So the only alternative that parents have if a district fails to implement the standards is to file a complaint. And we've had quite a few instances recently where parents tried to file a complaint and were unable to do so because a district was not meeting that section of the 22s.
Any questions for this group? I want to parrot what Senator Gelser has said in the sense that I have worked with you forever. I agree wholeheartedly that these kids are uniquely different, when identified correctly, than any of our other special needs kinds of students. And we need to make sure we get services that make it work. And you should be proud because you have helped get services for some kids, even if it was only on an individual basis. So for some of us, we see you as the person in the little poem about this starfish is going to get back in the water. We see you as being one of those people that's always picking up starfish and trying to make sure it works. So I appreciate you, and we'll see what we can do with this bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Roblin.
Yep.
Does any?
Okay. I think we have two. Oh, you have another bill. Another
well,
bill.
Yeah, but you want me to, do you want to hear the opponents first?
You can go. No, she can go.
Okay. All right. Do you want me to just go ahead and talk about
yep.
the other bill? Okay. Again, for the record, Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21. I'm here today to request your support for Senate Bill 887. In the 2015 legislative session, while I was serving in the House, I served on the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. And at that time, ODE was going over their strategic investments. The committee learned about advanced placement enrollment numbers and demographics, as well as numbers and demographics for students who qualify for advanced placement courses, whether or not they are enrolled in those advanced placement classes. And the point of this was that we were having a conversation about how many kids and which kids are in advanced placement classes. And so it's through this process that I learned about the problem that this bill is trying to address. I found these numbers to be rather upsetting. The vast majority of students enrolled in advanced placement classes are Caucasian, and very large numbers of students identified as having AP potential, measured by their PSAT exam scores, had not participated in AP courses. In a news release put out in 2014 by the Department of Education, which is available on OLIS, ODE wrote, over 8,300 students in Oregon's 2013 graduating class took at least one advanced placement exam at some point during high school, an increase of 300 students over the prior year. This represents 24% of the graduating class, up from 23% in 2012. However, despite more than doubling overall advanced placement participation over the last decade, the state continues to see low numbers of historically underserved students participating in these exams. The release also states parents and teachers can help by encouraging students to take AP classes or other accelerated courses. I appreciate and I'm grateful that ODA has invested funds to help cover the costs of exams for students and better prepare students to take the exam. I believe additional work is needed to make certain students are aware that these courses are available and they are qualified to take the AP classes. Senate Bill 887 seeks to help address this problem by ensuring students and their parents or guardians are notified when their PSAT scores indicate that they have the potential to take AP courses. I sought to keep the language flexible for ODE to work with school districts on the process for notification. This is a simple bill, and again, the intent is to encourage students who have been identified as having AP potential to take AP classes, which of course helps them prepare for college. Thank you, Chair Robel and members of the committee, and I urge your support for Senate Bill 887.
Any questions for Senator Taylor? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
And while we're bringing up, we might still stay on that summon. Terry Whitney. Oh, we can also, we'll do both bills. So we'll bring up Richard and Morgan, Allen and Richard Donovan. That's all of the people signed up for both of these bills. We can have that done. And I do want to stay while they're coming up. The Senate Bill 253, which we had for a work session today, will not be taken up today because we don't have the paperwork. We can't move it. So we will be carrying it over, I can say carrying over, to Monday or Tuesday. We tried to get the paperwork. It didn't come. So, yes, let's start with Terry first.
Senator Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Terry Whitney. I am the Government Relations Director, West Region for the College Board. As I think you're aware, the College Board administers the SAT AP courses in high schools across the globe, and we are here as strong supporters of Senate Bill 887. I really wanted to basically underscore a lot of the verbiage that you heard from the sponsor. I also wanted to give you a bit of history in terms of the role that AP has played since its introduction almost 60 years ago. The College Board's AP program has been delivering excellence in education to millions of students across the country for 56 years. During the first AP exam administration, 1,229 students in 104 schools sat for 2,199 AP exams. By 2016, those numbers had grown to 2.6 million students in nearly 22,000 schools, sitting for 4.7 million exams. AP currently offers 38 courses in a wide variety of subject areas, including art, computer science and mathematics, world languages and culture, natural and physical sciences, English, government and politics. Students who participate in AP dig deeper into the subjects they love, exploring new ideas with their classmates and teachers while facing unique challenges and learning skills that will lead to increased readiness for life after high school. In the fall of 2016, AP launched its newest course, AP Computer Science Principles, or APCSP. It is designed to broaden the invitation to computer science, especially to students who are traditionally underrepresented in the computer science field. I note that these are the exact students that the sponsor spoke of who are currently not meeting those opportunities in your state. Over 2,500 schools are offering APCSP in its first year, making it the largest course launch in AP's history. CSP expands access to computer science education, and we know that this will prepare students for important jobs of tomorrow. With that, I'll close in case you have questions.
So any questions? Thank you very much. Now for the other bill. And you can head off or stay, whichever you want to do with the other two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan Allen here on behalf of COSA on the other bill, Senate Bill 887.
889.
Or excuse me, 889. And we don't have any issues and are actually supportive of the portion of the bill that would require a study of TAG funding, and I've worked with and would not recommend anyone tangle with Ms. DeLacy on these issues over the years. I've had opportunity to work with her, and just today we were talking about trying to find some money for professional development for teachers for TAG this session. But Section 3, we do have some concerns about. If you remember, and we have the two folks on this committee that were the chairs of the education committees at the time, in 2011 and 2013, we had some pretty significant discussions about mandate relief. And there were several bills that passed, and the governor's office was involved. And one of the changes that was made was in regards to the Division 22 reports. And the reason the Division 22 reports are important is because anything in those administrative rules, essentially a school district has to do in order to be considered a standard school in Oregon. And the big stick with that is if you're out of compliance, the department can withhold state school fund money. So those are like the most serious of all administrative rules. But one of those pieces of mandate relief was to modify the Division 22 reporting process. And note, it's about reporting, not compliance. So the changes made were about how districts report, not whether they have to be in compliance with the rules or not. And basically, instead of submitting the big, long checklist every year, ODE came up with something that's actually proved pretty popular with our folks. And actually, I think I could argue, actually creates more work for our folks, but is a better process and more meaningful process. And that is every third year, so the first, it basically created a three-year cycle, and year one you report on all of them, and then in years two and three, ODE asks some detailed questions about maybe somewhere between five or six of the Division 22 things, and asks districts to respond in a more meaningful way about what they're doing in order to be in compliance. And in fact, TAG has been one of those questions in 2014, 2015. I would argue that we got more information about what districts were doing to be in compliance with TAG probably based on that report. And my understanding is TAG is in the rotation again. And what Section 3 does, it basically restores the old system where districts are just turning in the check boxes every year about whether or not they're in compliance. They still have to do this, as Ms. DeLacy said, with their local school boards every year. They turn in these forms. Again, the new system has proven to be more popular with our folks, and we would encourage you not to change it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. Just to follow up on what my colleague Morgan said, I just want to underscore the value of this kind of three-year cycle, this rotational system. In those years two and three, so in year one, there's the full checklist is delivered. In those years two and three, that full checklist is delivered to local school boards. So there isn't the report directly to ODE, but as Morgan said, the local community does receive that information. We think that's totally appropriate and perhaps even a better use of that information than having it go into the state. And then, as Morgan said, these kind of in-depth questions have proven over time to be more valuable, to be more effective, and more valuable to school districts, administrators, and educators in terms of evaluating the programs that are offered in schools. So we think the current system is good. We also do not have any concerns with the TAG study in the first portion of the bill. We're only concerned with Section 3 of the bill, the Division 22 requirements. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you all.
Thanks, Senator.
That does it for that. Is there anyone else that was going to talk to these that didn't sign up? We're going to close public hearings on Senate Bill 887 and 889, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 911. Senator Farioli, and whoever wants to come up, who you would like to have come up with you.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there are several that would like to testify.
Yeah, there are a few, yes. And I think you might all work. Cheryl Kennedy, Philip Mocha. We also have Michael, is it Moore? Who's the other? This is good, though. So, Senator Farioli.
I'm Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ted Farioli. I represent District 30. All are part of 11 counties, 34,000 square miles, encompassing at least two Native American homelands. Senate Bill 911 is the Indian Health Scholarship Program, and it establishes Indian Health Scholarships to help qualifying members of the nine federally recognized tribes to access health professional education. This is necessary, and let me just share a personal experience. In rural Oregon, we chase doctors, we chase nurses, we chase practitioners, PAs, physician's assistants, dentists. And we do that because it's hard sometimes to recruit those highly qualified medical specialists to come live in rural communities. One of the things that works maybe not so well is trying to recruit people from urban areas to come and make the lifestyle change to relocate into highly urbanized areas. One of the things that we found that is very successful is that if we can find people who are already acculturalized, who are already in a community network, who have a support system in the community, and educate them to provide the services that we need, those are much better fits for our community. And if that's true for the general population in rural communities in Oregon, east, west, north, south, it's doubly true for the Native American populations. So this scholarship is aimed precisely at finding bright young people who would come to institutions of higher learning and gain these skills to provide medical services and health care directly to a population that they come from. They also are obligated to agree to provide specific services for a specific duration in an agreement they would sign on acceptance of the scholarship. So it literally becomes a contract with communities to educate very bright young people to get the skills that they need. They would get assistance in the form of access to scholarship funds. They'd go back to their communities and begin practice, and in so doing, they would meet and fulfill their obligation and, in fact, earn their education by providing direct services to their communities. We think this is a really good model. And, you know, I'll be happy to defer to the other members who've wished of the panel who wish to testify for this bill. But we think this is an investment that we ought to make in communities that are underserved, that have a desire to participate, and that have young people who are eager to enter the program. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Cheryl, you want to go next?
Sure.
Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here to provide testimony on behalf of this bill. Chair Roblin, I serve with you on the Commission on Indian Services. It's always a joy, and I'm glad to be here to speak before all of you. Thank you for your time. I'm Cheryl Kennedy. I'm the Vice Chair of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. I'm also the Vice Chair of the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board, which serves all of the tribes of Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. I'm here today to support of Senate Bill 911. As we heard from the previous testimony, some of the areas of concern are number one, it's a greatly underserved population, the Native American population of Oregon, that we have a greater disease burden than other populations, and it's very hard to recruit professionals because of our rurality. So we do support this bill. The Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde and our Health and Wellness Center currently provide medical, dental, optometry, behavioral health, lab, x-ray, pharmacy, and community health services. So it's a one-stop shopping medical service that we provide. In 2016, the Health and Wellness Center served more than 60,000 patients during more than 22,000 patient visits, which I believe is over what the norms are in other clinics. The patients come from all over Oregon, but are primarily from Yamhill, Polk, and Marion counties. Approximately 70% of the total patients are American Natives or Alaskan Natives, with the remaining 30% being from our non-Native community members. We are thankful to Senators Roblin, Ferrioli, and Cruz, along with Oregon Health Sciences University, for their cooperative spirit and for reaching out to Oregon tribes to establish this program. We look forward to a relationship that will bring together efforts between Oregon's premier learning institution, Oregon's federally recognized Indian tribes, and our rural communities. We know that there are amendments being offered to address policy concerns that we have, and we look forward to working out those issues with Oregon Health Sciences University and the Oregon tribes in the future. Some of the issues in the amendment to be addressed in the future are Senate Bill 911 requires the scholarship recipient be a member of a federally recognized tribe. Grand Ronde would like to see preference given first to members of federally recognized Oregon tribes, second to residents of Oregon who are members of federally recognized tribes, and third to all other members of federally recognized tribes, because there are 565 tribes in the United States. By limiting scholarships to only members of Oregon tribes, the pool of potential recipients could become too narrow. But allowing members of all federally recognized tribes could result in a flood of applications looking to take advantage of the program only to eventually return to their own home state. Using a three-tiered preference system would provide Oregon's tribal members and residents of Oregon the best opportunity to access potential scholarship funds. Another point to be made is Senate Bill 911 requires a recipient to sign a service agreement in which the recipient agrees to practice at a tribal service site for a minimum of 2 years immediately upon completion of their program. Grand Ronde would recommend service site be defined as a health care facility located on an Indian reservation in Oregon. Grand Ronde would propose a recipient be required to first apply for employment with all nine federally recognized tribes in Oregon. If none of these tribes offer the recipient a position, the recipient should then be required to seek employment with another facility located off reservation that serves primarily Indian people. This would provide a concerted effort to bring quality medical services to healthcare facilities in Oregon communities. Senate Bill 911 requires a recipient who fails to complete the medical or dental program or fails to adhere to the terms of the service agreement upon completion of the program to repay the entire amount of the scholarship plus an additional 10% of the total scholarship received as a penalty. Grand Ronde suggests limiting the required repayment only to the amount of scholarship and remove the 10% penalty. Grand Ronde believes that the cost of tuition and fees are so high for these types of programs that requiring a recipient to repay the total amount of the scholarship would be sufficient penalty for failing to complete the program or the service agreement. I just want to mention that Oregon is a unique state in that there have been many efforts that Oregon has partnered with tribes, and among them that we see today are the passage of Senate Bill 770, which provides the government-to-government consultation process between the state of Oregon and the nine tribes of Oregon. There's been a long history, beginning with our Governor Atiyah on down to today, and so we do have a strong relationship. We greatly appreciate it, and we again ask for support of this bill. We believe it's a wonderful bill. Thank you.
Thank
Questions?
You.
Thank you, Chairman Roblin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Phil Maruca. I've served as a dean of the OHSU School of Dentistry since 2013 and have over 25 years of experience in the administration of graduate dental education. Our motto at OHSU School of Dentistry is ready to practice for Oregon. Upon graduation from our rigorous four-year program, we are firmly committed to training the next cadre of dentists for all of Oregon, and especially the areas currently underserved. That is why our students have community service rotations in virtually every part of the state. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 911, establishing an Indian Health Scholarship in Oregon. I strongly believe this legislation will be another important component in providing full preventative and primary care to a vitally important and often underserved community in our state. That preventative and primary care would include full-service dentistry under the interprofessional scholarship program proposed in Senate Bill 911. I support the amendments to strengthen the bill as introduced, including limiting eligibility to only Oregon tribal members. That would be my preference. I don't have much of a problem with the others that were mentioned before, except that I think it puts a little pressure on us to go out and seek those people to fill the pipeline. I think it's too easy to just expect that people will come to us, but that's not enough. We have to seek to fill the pipeline. Providing a service commitment on a one-to-one ratio, that is, a four-year dental student would commit to 4 years of providing primary and preventative dental care. That's the way it is in the Rural Health Initiative. I think it's a reasonable, given the cost, it's a reasonable payback for the times, for the dollars provided. Establishing a service commitment that shall be provided at only Oregon Tribal Reservation Clinics, administering the scholarship program through OHSU in partnership with the tribes, allowing private donations from individuals and charitable organizations to establish a corpus from which investment returns could be used to help fund the scholarship in addition to state funding. Regarding the state funding for the 2017 to 2019 budget, I believe OHSU can handle the startup cost necessary for this program through existing budgets for outreach to undergraduate pre-med and pre-dental students. We are already working on on outreach through our on-track OHSU program. OHSU is committed to taking the necessary steps in close collaboration with Oregon tribes in developing a pipeline of Oregon Indian students qualify for admission to OHSU graduate schools and the scholarship proposed in Senate Bill 911. The necessary groundwork for the scholarship would require much of the 2017-2019 biennium, possibly relieving the legislature of funding of the actual scholarship until the 2019-21 biennial budget. Existing programs address underserved Medicaid and rural communities, including the Rural Practitioners Tax Credit, the Rural Practitioner Insurance Subsidies, and the Medicaid Primary Care Loan Repayment and Forgiveness Programs. The Indian Health Scholarship Program will address an overlooked, underserved community in Oregon. It will provide a tuition and fee-free graduate health provider education for Oregon tribal members who will serve in their tribal health care facilities and give back to their tribal community in a very real and significant way. Thank you for your opportunity to testify. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Any questions from any of the people?
Mr. Yes. Chair, just in a point of clarification, the Association of American Medical Colleges estimates that the debt average for a medical student graduating from an institution is $183,000. That does not include any money that they may have spent in their undergraduate studies. To expect this underserved population to access the undergraduate costs plus the almost $200,000 it costs to get through a medical education puts this service objective beyond the reach of most communities and beyond the reach of most Indian students. This, based on need, this would be a great investment. The opportunity to make the connection between very bright young people, resources to create a medical education, and an Indian based medical facility that serves that population is an opportunity I don't think we can afford to pass up. So, and Mr. Chair, may I say, so far we only have two members of the committee as chief sponsors. And as you work this bill, which I know you need to do, I certainly would support the amendments that I've heard suggested here to better target the resources to the Oregon federally recognized tribes and the lengthening of the service agreement if the committee sees fit. But I also would welcome additional chief sponsors to the bill.
I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Lithica? No, just giving you a bad time. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have a representative from the Warm Springs, Michael Mason. If there's anybody else out there that would like to testify that hasn't signed up, they're welcome to come up at this moment.
Thank you, Chairman Roblin, and members of the Senate Education Committee. And we appreciate you bringing forward this bill. I'm careful to call it 911.
Who art thou?
Oh, I'm forgetting. No, my for the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. And I've been told I have about 30 seconds. No, I'm just kidding. But I apologize for my illegible handwriting. I can't read my writing at this point in the session either. So it's not a surprise. I wanted to just point out that, you know, as the other witnesses have done, this addresses a serious need. Yes, there's an Indian Health Service scholarship program that this is based on, but the Indian Health Service has been chronically underfunded. The deal that's been made with tribes in Oregon is, well, you know, we don't have a lot of money, Indian Health Service would tell us, so we'll provide staff, but you've got to build it. You've got to pay for the equipment. You know, all the capital construction and equipment has to be fall on the tribe itself, which, of course, one of the great benefits of tribal gaming has been the ability to pay for that throughout the state. So I want to mention another problem, and that's that there's very, very little preventive care at all that IHS can afford to handle. The only area really has been in the last 10 years diabetes that I'm aware of. And of course, Vice Chair Kennedy is more familiar with these issues than I. But just to point out the great need, and as she pointed out, I think at all the clinics there is not, this is not just a benefit to the tribal members. It's a benefit to, you know, the folks in Oregon, the citizens of Oregon who are not first Oregonians. So I would say that the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs would support the bill with some amendments, as have been discussed, a preference for tribal Oregon tribal members, I should say, 3-year service, that sort of thing. But we'll look at the amendments, hopefully, with a work session for next week. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Senator.
Just a comment. Just to reference back, the rural scholarship program we established at OHSU is working wonderfully well, and this is the same sort of model. So, I mean, we've already got a track record of success.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I will say that most people understand there's only about 3 more meetings that we have an opportunity to pick this bill, so we need to get the amendments quickly. I know that there are at least 3 senators up here, which should help you, and my staff is at your disposal, but we need to get on it and get an agreement with everybody fairly quickly so we can get this scheduled. Okay, just wanted to make sure that was clear. With that, we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 911. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 576 and 443, and we will invite Senator Farioli back. And if Canope is anywhere around?
Senator Canope has been called away to another important hearing.
Okay.
So I will fill in, if that's okay with
Mr.
Chair.
That's absolutely okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ted Farioli, District 30, members of the committee. I'm here in support of both Senate Bill 576 and 443. Which, if you look at the bills, realize that they are virtually the same objectives and a lot of the same language.
Yeah.
But I will start by quoting Will Rogers. Will Rogers once said that there isn't an institution of higher learning or a college in the entire United States that doesn't, because of some inherent weakness in the system, from time to time turn out a senator or a representative. It just happens that way. It's it's nobody's fault. It just happens.
That's a good point.
One of the things that they need to turn out, and unfortunately we sometimes see lawyers, public relations consultants, English majors, and political science majors as well, but what we really need is engineers. And Senate Bill 443 offers to solve that problem by directing some of the STEM dollar investments to very specific purposes, including math and career technical education that will assist us in solving some of the problems that we encounter by not having well-qualified engineers and mathematicians and other folks that the STEM-related degrees focus on. So what the bill does actually is it requires at least 25% of the Oregon Opportunity Grant monies to be awarded to students committing to major in science, technology, engineering, or mathematics. Not that we don't need more lawyers or more public relations consultants or more English majors or more poli-sci majors, but we definitely need more students who get to earn their degrees in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. That is what these two bills are aimed at. So, Mr. Chair, if there are questions, I will be happy to answer them.
So I have one question. Do we know what percentage of current students that are getting opportunity grants are science majors or whatever? Do we have that? Have they collected that data?
The data that I have shows that there is a very high demand for these graduates. I don't have the relative numbers, but the jobs in the STEM sectors are growing at 10.5% per year, and now there's currently about 817,000 of these jobs that are out there in the, you know, U.S. wide. Certainly there's a similar percentage by population in Oregon. When I talk to folks in economic development, what they tell me is that the potential for growth in our society is in the STEM sectors. So, you know, this is something that I believe is a worthwhile investment, and if we're going to target education for success, then the STEM areas are what we're seeing the greatest interest in. Also, there's a lot of interest in education today in career technical education, and CTE leads directly to employment, and STEM leads directly to lifetime careers. So we think these are the right areas to target.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? No. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the committee, for your rapt attention, and please help us create more engineers and scientists and mathematicians, and we'll leave the others to take care of themselves. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, they'll help the others, because math people are always helpful.
No comment.
Okay. Kyle Thomas and Cindy Robert.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I do have some of the data that is reflective of the question you just asked. We don't have the data as it pertains to OOG, Oregon Opportunity Grant students specifically, and actually right now we don't have the community college information, but I can tell you at the university level, 29% of first-time, full-time university students enter majors that we would consider to be STEM majors. Now, by the time they graduate, that that number does drop to about 25.5%. So to Senator Ferrioli's point, it looks like some of those students ultimately do end up deciding to be lawyers after all.
Okay.
Just to, without commenting on the merits of the bill at all, just to point out a couple of the administrative issues that HEC sees in the language. The first is that at the time of application for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, students are still seniors in high school. And so they are unlikely at that point and unlikely for a significant period of time after they fill out the application for federal student aid to have declared a major. So if these items do move forward, we would have to come up with some sort of alternative way to identify students who are committed to studying STEM. The second observation with the legislation is that Oregon Opportunity Grants are awarded year after year, and so the language of the bill would seem to imply that year after year we have to remix the population to assure that at least 25% of students are receiving grants. And so we could do that a couple of ways. One of the ways is if we see that number dropping too low, we may have to adjust the incoming freshman mix to be higher than 25%. So you could end up with the situation that students who are otherwise qualified for the opportunity grant do not receive it because of decisions that students that came before them made. The other way we could target that is by ultimately reducing the amount of grant award and awarding more students if we needed to end up awarding more students who had committed to STEM. Those are the comments that we have in the bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. And since you'd like a statistic, I'll give you one. 25% of the students who have bachelor degrees in STEM areas come from one of our schools. So 25%, which is really great. So I'm going to go back in time before Kyle was at the HEC. We actually had a work group called the Financial Aid Work Group. And it was led by a gentleman named Larry Roper. And Larry Large, who used to be my boss at the Alliance, was on it as well. So when Larry couldn't go, I had the privilege of standing in for him. And I learned a lot there about the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And the goal of the group was to make sure it was the most efficient use of dollars it could be, because there's not enough money. We send away a lot of people who qualify for the funding without the money because there isn't enough to go around. But that report, which should be handed out to you, parts of it, only 4 pages, it's a 28-page document, outlines some of the decisions that were made by that group on how to best apply OOG. And first and foremost, you've probably heard before, it was to the neediest of all students. Second, there was an equity lens that was applied to it. Third, it was based on some academic achievement when you got it the next year, so some higher goals. And fourth, some predictability. If you got it the first year, we wanted to make sure you got it the second year. Those were the four top things that we did to the OOG to make it more efficient. And I just wanted to make sure you knew these things had been considered, they have been done, and we're happy with the outcomes so far, except for we need more money, and we're getting the STEM students in there as well.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Lithgow.
With regard to declaration, you spoke a little bit to receiving and then a desire to see continuing effort in that regard. And your testimony was with regard to people who haven't declared, don't know it. Can you explain how that would work if I choose a STEM major just to get finances, and then in my third year I ditch out to language or to be a lawyer and am no longer participating, but you funded me for a couple of years of university life, and then reverse it the other way? I join the university system or college using the grant funds as a language major, and then I discover math is my, you know, my love, and I step into that. How does that even out in using this 25% number an example?
Senator Roblin, Senator Linthicum, the bill is actually appears to me to be rather silent on that question by giving the HEC the authority to handle that question by rule. At this point, we haven't considered what kind of rule we would develop to address that specific concern. I will say that any rule that we develop, we have to be bound by that 25%. So if you do change your major and there's room within that STEM, non-STEM mix to continue to accommodate your award, then it's potentially possible that your award would continue to be accommodated. If you are dropping out of a STEM major, and we are already at the situation where we need to award more OOG dollars to non-STEM students, it's potential that you would face lack of eligibility for that award.
Mr. Chair, Senator, so this is a perfect example of where a really great idea is going to have problems in the details. But I have asked my schools, and I'll get this to you as soon as I get the answer, to do a little polling and figure out what rules are about declaring majors in your freshman year. Kyle and I had a conversation about, hadn't we heard somewhere that, you know, not only do we not want students to, we kind of discourage them. We want them to go to the school and try a whole bunch of things, like you say, and make up their mind. So I am polling the schools right now to find out if, in fact, any of them have rules about that or if we're just silent on it, and then I'll get you that as well.
Okay. Any other questions?
I'll just add for, you know, a character insight. I was a comparative literature major for my freshman and sophomore year, and as I became a junior, I snapped my fingers and said, well, the only place I can work would be in a school system or university. I need a real job.
And luckily for me, I discovered calculus, and quarter after quarter after quarter for calculus was an easy A for me, and I funneled my entire college career down a different path entirely. But I didn't like math when I start. Well, I didn't think I did,
right.
Until it improved my GPA. So I'm the odd duck, the odd duck who went the other way. But it's a great issue to be dealing with.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. That's all for those bills. If there's anybody else that was missed, let me know. Seeing no one jumping to that, we're going to close the public hearings on Senate Bill 576 and 443, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 353. And with that, we'll invite our good senator to come on up and enjoy the moment in front of our committee.
I do. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Roblin. I'm Lou Frederick, Senator from District 22, North and Northeast Portland. And I did both of those things, by the way, just so that you know, Senator Lithicum. I managed to start off in biology and get a degree in theater. So with a minor in biology. But
it serves you well here, doesn't it?
It does. It serves me well here. But it was one of the greatest little schools in the United States, Earlham College, right?
Senator Gelson. This has been a big Earlham day.
Yes, it's been a big Earlham day. Thank you. But I wanted to talk with you a little bit about Senate Bill 353.
Did you identify yourself?
I did.
Thank you.
I was ahead of myself too.
Thank you
for that change. One of the things I've discovered in dealing with it so far in the Senate is an attempt to try to solve problems, not just to identify them, but to solve problems. And the question is how. Do we solve problems? I want to start off with the fact that the premise for Measure 98, which is what this bill is about, is based on, is laudable. We need to increase the opportunities for students in career and technical education. That is abundantly clear. But I worry that several mistakes made in the past would be repeated as we attempted to fix a problem, specifically three mistakes. The first was not asking the students, educators, parents, and community what was needed and what was working. The second was relying on threats and top-down management as the model for motivating and supporting students, teachers, and school districts. And the third was relying on rhetoric, labels like at risk or the promise of a simple solution to Oregon's high dropout rate and the elusive increasing state revenue. Effective programs start with the expectation that there will be enough adults available to assess the interests and needs of individual students and the time to work with those students as they move through the uneven path of intellectual and emotional development that comes with aging. And to be effective regarding CTE and Measure 98, we need to respect the expertise of the community, the districts, the schools, the teachers, the parents, and especially the students. In education, I'm afraid threat has been used as a broad tactic in areas that were not only unnecessary but counterproductive. Students need to trust the adults around them, not be on guard because the next person they encounter might create a new barrier. At best, fear is a short-term motivator. At worst, it serves as a long-term hindrance to a child's learning. But it provides numbers and easy statistics to compare. However, it does not provide proof that those numbers represent what we want for our children or our schools. We are all aware of the $1.6 billion deficit facing our state, and I worried that Measure 98 would increase class size in regular classrooms because the money would be taken to pay for a prescriptive series of programs. The effect would continue a serial disruption, undercutting the confidence in public education. It could also fortify a political approach that calls for external private groups to, quote, solve the problem, end quote. In my view, Oregon's high dropout rate, which is a target of Measure 98, is not tied to the loss of one program, but rather to a much more insidious effort of two generations of budget cuts, limited classroom options, and poorly designed incentives for students. Why go to school if your teachers are forced to tell you that the primary goal of education is not learning, but passing the test? Why stay in school if you've been given the support, have not been given the support you need via counseling, academic tutoring, or simple safety, food, and shelter? Why stay in school if the things that you're interested in fall outside the math and reading emphasis or college prep path? What if you like mechanical systems, photography, dance, art, music, carpentry, or theater, and they are pushed to the side by cash-strapped and compliance-based school districts. Why stay in school when it's clear that you have been labeled as a failure and a problem from the time you showed up in kindergarten because you fit into the at-risk category due to your skin color, ethnic background, religion, family language, or economic level? When you cut programs for two generations of students in Oregon, even their parents can't remember a time when options included multiple language classes, ceramics, freshman band, choir, science clubs, broadcasting, and regular field trips to business, concerts, art and science museums, and the natural wonders of our state. As students, their grandparents raised money for band uniforms, not chemistry teachers. Requiring districts to adopt particular programs to prevent dropouts seems a bit short-sighted. I'd rather support programs they already have and suggest ideas tailored to that school district or that school. I often tell students several things. One of the things I say is I apologize for the adults of Oregon because we have not taken care of their needs and instead spend time, energy, and money in political battles and skirmishes over power. It seems at times that greed and ill-placed revenge directs the decisions. We have the resources in our state to provide for a well-rounded education for all of Oregon students. Most of those, or many of those resources, now flow out of the state because of our outdated revenue systems. Senate Bill 353-1, and I encourage you to look at the amendment, allows the flexibility of each community needs to best provide for its students. What is needed or of interest should be determined by the individual educational ecosystem in each district and the community surrounding the schools. And perhaps most importantly, SB 351, 353-1 acknowledges the professionalism of the people working with students every day. Let's make sure that we actually follow best practices and allow professionals to have the flexibility to use the law that we've passed to make a difference with our future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Just comment, because the Senator and I have had many conversations on this subject, and you know, there's lots of things we need to look at. What popped into my head, and this was back in 1999, in the Oregon House, we passed a mandate on schools. This was at the behest of a then representative by the name of Tony Corcoran, that we needed to teach the Irish potato famine. Okay, and it passed. So it's a mandate on schools. You know, the problem is, we need to give the schools the freedom to educate kids and not mandate all these things. So I understand exactly where you're going with this. Is we don't want to be prescriptive in what we're doing. We want to be flexible. So, because when the power's at the school district level, the product is much better.
So, and my question is, now we talked about this a little bit. As you read Measure 98, do you see it as totally inflexible? So, for example, I have a school district we've invested in CT because we know our kids really want it, and we've got a great program, it's producing. The legislature comes to a session and sends back enough money to fund part of school, but I have to cut that program because I don't have enough money to do it. The way you see 98, and we're talking about it, could you use that money to replace that old program you had, or would you have to invent a new one?
Well, as I read it, I don't see it as allowing you to, you know, to replace that old program. I think it is creating a new one. Now, I may be wrong on that, but that's how I read what 98 appears to say. I think that the support, we have some really extraordinary programs. I know you're going to hear from one program today because I saw her sitting back there, Deb Barnes. Clackamas, North Clackamas, has one of the best programs for CTE in the state.
Yes, yes.
There's no question at all about that. Whereas in Portland, the Portland School District has dismantled much of the CTE program for years. They're trying to rebuild it now, but they dismantled it for a while, and I was watching that and arguing against it at the time. But there was clearly, we need to figure out how we're going to support the programs that each district really has and keep them going, as well as perhaps give some additional support for them. That's what I think Dash 1 does. It allows that flexibility.
Mr. Chair, that was part of our conversation, is it's great if we're funneling money here, but we don't want to penalize those who are a step ahead or penalize those who are a step behind. It flows to the district to do the best job that fits their needs.
That's so, my approach. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Senator Federer? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So let's go with our first panel, Lori Wimmer. Deborah Barnes. And let's see, one other one here. Deb Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing 44,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, who are very pleased to see that Oregonians showed their support for public education in Oregon when they supported Measure 98, which I believe they pretty much thought of for one of its three elements, the CTE element, which is so important. We are also excited about the opportunity to work on retention of our students when they're having problems or accelerating where appropriate. We all want a system of public education that serves the diverse needs of our students. And we have heard that some argue that our concerns about this measure as written signal that we don't share those values. I would like to be crystal clear that that is not the case. We do. We're not worried about the what. We're worried about the how. And so in requesting the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 353, it was our hope that we could fix the how so that this program does work in all school districts for all kids. So I just want to be really clear about that. I've heard a lot of chatter otherwise. And so you have my written testimony in your system. I'd like to just summarize some of the high points of what we considered to be technical or mechanical problems and how the -1 amendments fix them. First of all, let's talk about funding. Obligating future legislatures to come up with money for specific line items without creating a funding stream to pay for them is problematic on two levels. First, it boxes the legislature in to deploy funds for a limited use. And it's a statutory measure. You really can't bind future legislatures, but that's what the act proposes to do. Second, without creating a funding source, it effectively pits educational programs against each other. Measure 98 was put in the grant and aid budget, and some of the programs it's now going to compete with for that $116 million targeted cut in the co-chair's framework are early intervention and early childhood special education services, Oregon Pre-K, youth development programs, and the Blind Visually Impaired Student Fund. These are just some of the programs serving vulnerable populations that Measure 98 now has to compete dollar for dollar with. Senate Bill 353 leaves the funding level in any biennium up to the Ways and Means process, although it does ensure that it is continuously appropriated. Duplication is the second problem we see in the act as written. It's a concern related to funding, especially in these resource-scarce times, because it's inefficient to be duplicative. Measure 98, as envisioned, duplicates efforts already provided in our schools, and the program should be tailored to supplement, not supplant, those efforts. This measure will do that because it grants the option to the school districts. We believe in efficiency, we believe in local control, and we believe in flexibility. All of those are values that we try to have fidelity with in the rewrite. Districts should be able to decide to add to existing programs, start up new ones, or redirect monies to other grant-approved uses without micromanagement or one-size-fits-all thinking. Flexibility is a key theme here. Because the measure imposes a mandate on school districts to spend the grant monies they may receive in all three areas of focus, they will not be able to, for instance, double down on a particularly glaring need for the students in their schools. They have to dilute the power of this grant by spreading the resources thin. In a rulemaking advisory group meeting a few months ago, even the measure's author admitted that this was problematic. But he argued that a district could spend $1 out of 100, for example, on Part A, $1 on Part B, and $98 on Part C. Well, if the sponsors are neutral about the proportionality of the deployment of the grant money, why couldn't they do $0 on Part A, $0 on Part B, and $100 on Part C if that serves their kids best. Senate Bill 353-1 enables that to happen. Local control, as I've mentioned, is a problem. The measure takes it away. It is a top-down mandate, as the senator said. Despite the fact that the Oregon Department of Education's community forums on the Every Child Succeeds Act, our OEA data from the 2016 symposium and Voices from the Field, and the ODE ESSA work groups all elevated the principle of local communities being involved in helping shape local education. We support returning decision-making to those who know about their students' needs. A key feature of Senate Bill 353-1 is that it reinstitutes local control so the educators who know the needs of their students best will be in the driver's seat. Bureaucracy is another point I'd like to mention, particularly because most people have completely overlooked Section 11, which institutes a mandated and very expensive annual performance audit. They call it a program audit, but that's a distinction without a difference. I just spoke with the audits division yesterday on this. That the Secretary of State has to perform every year of the grant on every school district. And because of the way it's written, theoretically, all but 11 school districts could actually receive this money. That would mean that all but 11 school districts would have to go through this very expensive performance audit. I was the vice chair of the Business Best Practices Performance Audit Advisory Committee a number of years ago, and I know just enough to be dangerous. And what we learned in that process is that Secretary of State program audits cost about $100,000 to $150,000 per school district per year and take an enormous amount of time. The audits division told me yesterday that they charge somewhere between $120 and $130 an hour, and the most recent education audits they've done took about 2,000 to 3,000 hours. So if that gives you any idea of the kinds of costs, there are probably about 80 school districts who could be recipients of this grant money who would pay more in the performance audit because it's the burden of the school district to pay for it. They pay more for the audit than they would get in the grant. That's crazy to me. We have asked for that to come out as well in the Dash 1 amendments. Not because we're anti-accountability, but because we think that's an overreach and not necessary. When you have a grant maker who's gatekeeping the grant, you've got performance metrics, and you have a municipal or financial audit required at the end of each year.
We're at time.
One last thing I will say, and that is that we participated in a work group on the House side for Measure 98. I would say that the fate of that work group is uncertain, but it's our hope that the Senate will be able to take a lead on a comprehensive fix to the problems with this measure so that the students of Oregon may have access to those programs without having to supplant the programs that are underway that serve 82,000 students already in CTE in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin. I'm Deborah Barnes. I have taught at the Sabin Schellenberg Center for the past 23 years. This is the 86th time I've come before the legislative body to talk about CTE.
That's impressive.
I truly believe in what the Stanford Children folks tried to put together. It started with Kurt Schrader when he came to my school to understand what CTE was when he was on Ways and Means, and suddenly everyone started talking CTE, and then my good friend Brad Avakian came by Sabin Schellenberg, and the next round of CTE excitement came out. My concern is, as we talk about CTE, we don't talk about long-range, long-term funding. We're one of the only states in the country that doesn't have dedicated funding for CTE. And if you look at the states that do, they have the highest graduation rates in the nation. We continue to talk about this. 23 years of talking about this, I see it every day in my classroom. As I've told lawmakers over and over again, I teach broadcasting. I have a multi-million dollar television station. We are on the internet with a radio station, and kids are in the business now because they've had real life experiences. My concern with this whole situation is you can't run a program on $800 per kid, which is what's being allotted. I write grants every year to supplement my class, as do my peers at Sabin Schellenberg. It's been around for 50 years. It's the largest CTE center in Oregon. It has 4,000 students and 17 different programs. Our programs are expensive. One of the things I'd like to bring up as a revenue idea is we've got a whole bunch of corporations in Oregon who want to have well-trained workers for the next century. We're building them in CTE. What's wrong with a corporation underwriting a manufacturing class at Sabin Schellenberg? Or how about a cosmetology program being picked up by a major company that does hair quality stuff? K2 is one of my business partners, and folks at the Oregon Storyboard Project are business partners. They not only help me get resources, but they start thinking long term. If this state is ever going to move forward with a higher graduation rate, and we've proven through data that it happens through CTE, over 90% of our kids who attend a CTE class for 2 years in a row, they'll graduate in this state. And I think we've got to start thinking about long-term funding for CTE. Finally, we've got AP. We've got IB. We've got a system in place in North Clackamas where we deal with the attendance problems, because if parents don't have those kids show up in school, eventually they're going to go into a courtroom. We've set it up that way, and a judge will say, you're being fined, get your kid back in school. So our attendance rate has improved. And frankly, it works in our district, and it's the proof is in the pudding. Our superintendent is the National Superintendent of the Year this year. And why is that? CTE, AP, IB, attendance, and equity. We believe CTE is the equalizer, the equity piece that every kid in this state needs in order to achieve success and be really college and career ready.
Thank you.
My name is Deb Mayer. I represent Parents Across America, Oregon. I'm here in support of Lou Frederick's Senate Bill 353-1. I'm going to talk a little bit about the money in a big picture kind of way. There were three ballot measures having to do with education this last election. Measure 99 proposed outdoor school for all with a funding stream. It was plain and simple, and it passed. Measure 97 proposed that certain corporations pay more in taxes to adequately fund our public schools. It was plain and simple also, and it failed. Then there was Measure 98. It proposed a complex, convoluted, costly, and inequitable plan to raise graduation rates by using less than the most effective methods. Not plain, not simple, and not funded. So what the heck is Measure 98 anyway? Here's what we know. Measure 98 was proposed by Stanford Children, a corporation that is largely funded by Bill Gates and other billionaires and millionaires. Quite frankly, Stanford Children is the mouthpiece for the billionaire elite who want to run our public schools. Their strategy is nothing short of genius. They figure that by spending a few million of their own money to promote Measure 98, they will gain access to $150 million a year from our state budget. If Bill Gates wants M98 so badly for Oregon kids, let him fund it. He can afford it. Oregon can't. From the beginning, Measure 98 was deceptively promoted. I think most voters would not have voted for it if they had known its true origin and intent. We should look into who profits from Measure 98 before giving it 1 cent of funding. I urge lawmakers to investigate and follow the money. Who will win and who will lose, because there will be winners and losers. I implore the OGE to shun the advice of Stanford Children. They are not education experts. They do not work in the best interest of children and educators. They didn't lift a finger to pass Measure 97, but now they want 1% of the entire state budget to fund their pet project. And they take money from Medicaid to do it. That's just sick. Frankly, I'm sick and tired of traveling to Salem as a grassroots organizer, only to find that the state favors the inane policies promoted by this phony AstroTurf corporation. This has to stop. Parents Across America Oregon urges that M98 not be funded at all. But if it is, only as amended in the version of the bill, SB 353-1, as presented by Lou Frederick. Thank you.
Thank you. I do want to say, personally, to Deborah Barnes, as a high school principal and a person who has been in awe of Owen Schoenberger, my dad was a vocational carpentry teacher in Washington who came to visit and was in awe those many years ago. We have tried in Coos County to, we have never quite got there, but I am proud that my high school still has a radio and broadcasting program, pirate radio, which was really pretty cool for us since we were the pirates, and the kids like that. We have a good welding program. We've got some other house building. We have kept those, and it's true. Those kids that stay in the program end up graduating, and so thank you for the work that you've done at Owen Saban for so long.
Thank you.
Yep. Next, we have Tim Frew and Mary, is it Thaman?
Thaman,
thank you. And Chris Allman.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Frew, and I am the Executive Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, representing over 25,000 construction workers and 21 member unions. The building trades is composed of 16 trades, each with their own apprenticeship program throughout the state. I'm here today in opposition to the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 353. The Oregon State Building Trades has been a strong advocate for CTE in Measure 98 as it creates a logical pathway into approved apprenticeship programs. It has been proven that students who have successfully participated in and graduated from CTE courses have a higher likelihood of being accepted to and completion of our apprenticeship programs. Our apprentices have an opportunity to earn while they learn with full family health insurance and a pension with no student debt upon graduation. Currently, the construction industry is experiencing a high demand for qualified skilled craftsmen due to the retirement of the baby boomer generation. I'm concerned that the Dash 1 amendment undermines the expansion of funding for CTE. And I believe that the fact that Measure 98 passed by a nearly 2-to-1 margin and at an approval rate of 66% should mean something. Thank you, and for that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll go across.
Oh,
no, we'll go across. You're right.
Oh, okay.
So you get to go first in the middle.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Chris Allman for the record. And I've been coming down to Salem for almost 15 years now, and Senator Haas will remember me when we were both much younger, coming to his eggs and coffee or whatever it was called, learning about the legislature. And over the course of time, especially with my interest in public schools, I've become a better person. I've become someone who's really following all sorts of legislation. And for me, having all my kids go through public schools, and now it's been 4 years since my son graduated, it will always take a center stage in terms of priorities for which I advocate. I'm not going to repeat many of the points that people have already made, which I say in my testimony, other than to really, again, emphasize that this campaign, which was really unopposed, who's going to fight, with big money, career and technical education, but it did come with a lot of dark money that was alluded to in terms of the money that Sanford Children gets. And because it was something that was confusing for the average voter in terms of the fact that it was an unfunded mandate, I think is a real problem, because we do have these initiatives, and that's fine. But in the end, you have to deal with whatever happens in terms of balancing the budget, in terms of what you do to either figure out how to raise money or not, or to get rid of expenditures. And for that, I do have great sympathy. I have excerpted many passages from Portland City Club's review of the ballot measure, the opposition in particular, because their points are again, echoing what others have said. And again, I don't think, as is often true with City Club, that the recognition that, well, if this isn't paid for, well, then how are we going to pay for it? Well, this is something that others have alluded to also, is that we have been underfunding education for a long time. I mean, that's why I started my efforts of coming down here on a regular basis as a citizen. So as you are working on this, and Senator Hask, in his role as the chair of the Finance Committee, I am begging you to raise corporate taxes to go beyond, so that we're reinvesting in public schools and getting the career technical education that, as the City Club has pointed out, in comparison from 1999 to 2000 school year, there were 1,202 programs in Oregon. Only 690 exist today. And that's what I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. My name is Mary Thaman. I'm from the Multnomah Democrats. And I'm here in support of SB 353-1. And the reason is because it proposes a task force to study this, to study the measure, which was an unmandated measure. And the thing of it is that there's a little matter of the $1.4 billion shortfall that Oregon faces. So that means that one has to be practical in looking at this. And I ran a dropout prevention program in a school in California, and this was many schools in the district from K to 12. And one thing that I know is that although it's very nice, it's very good to have CTE, a program for that, it's not the silver bullet at all. I mean, the dropout problem that there is in Oregon is a very complicated situation. And it goes all through the system, you know, preschool all the way up through high school, all the way through life. So it's not, having the CTE education setting that up is not going to be the answer of the thing. And then plus the fact is that you want to set up a central bureaucracy. It's going to take $338 million to set that up within the first 2 years, and you already have a program in place in the Portland schools for CTE. It's underfunded. They've been underfunding it ever since the passages of Measure 5 and 50, the 90s. This is 15 years later, and Oregon has big-time problems in education. So you have to be practical and look at what is the best result for your investment. And it just seems to put this on hold and till they can come up with the money. I mean, if you're going to pass a mandate, then come up with the money in some way. But to take away from other programs that have a proven track record, this doesn't make sense to me. This is a new program. It doesn't have a track record in place. The programs that you have in the schools presently, it does have a track record, and that's what you should be looking at, and you should be funding that. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? Thank you. So it looks like Joaquin Lippincott, Jason, is it Reish? Resch? It was close. and Celeste Edmond. Thank you for being here. And whoever wants to start.
Okay, I'll start. My name is Joaquin Lippincott, and I am the CEO of Metal Toad, a software company employing over 50 people in Portland, Oregon. I'm really excited to be here. This is my first time giving testimony. So you've heard earlier about the benefits of STEM education and how CTE can lead to amazing employment opportunities. And I am here to reiterate that this is indeed true. Our company is growing at 30% annually, and median income at our company is $90,000 per year. I'm proud that we are not only paying a significant amount into the Oregon tax system via these many jobs, but our employee benefits include things like unlimited paid time off, health and dental care for employees and their families. And this is pretty standard for the industry. Importantly, 50% of web developers do not have a computer science degree, making this an incredible opportunity for CTE. Unfortunately, to date, 90% of my workforce has come from outside Oregon. Kids in this state deserve a chance to get into tech, and we are on the cusp of being able to do just that. This is why I am opposed to Dash 1 amendment to the Senate Bill 353. By way of example, repealing the prohibition on backfilling to pay for existing programs is a huge step backward. This bill is also important to me personally because I am a huge believer in the power of public education and the father of two children, one of which is attending public high school here in Oregon. My mother was also a public high school teacher for two decades, and she supported our small family as a single parent. So I'm sensitive to the prior testimony of teachers that spoke before me, and I have huge respect for teachers as a profession. However, the true winners and losers in our education system are our many children. Public education exists to serve children, and we owe those kids better than the third worst graduation rate in the country. A number of proponents have spoken today about giving districts unfettered discretion around spending, yet, as you also heard earlier, PPS systematically dismantled their CTE programs over the past decades for reasons we don't know. This was a district-level decision that we cannot afford to have happen again in PPS or any other district in the state. I believe that Oregon students are the future of the state, and the question before this committee today is whether you want to invest in that future or in the past.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Thanks for having us. I'm a father of three. I am a CTE teacher at the secondary and post-secondary level. My name is Jason Resch, R-E-S-C-H. Again, father of three, educator, post-secondary, and secondary levels. And I'm also vice president of a bank here in town. I'm going to tell you a little story about my path. I was emancipated when I was 17. I was also a TAG student and in AP courses. While we were learning about Chaucer's Tales, it wasn't relevant to me. What I needed to do was take care of myself, and I needed that pathway. And I was able to drop out of school, and I didn't. And I didn't because of career tech education. I had a chance to learn about marketing, advertising, and branding. That was able to take me to a two-year program at the community college and two more years at the university. I became a high school teacher, moved here to Oregon, taught for 8 years, and then became a post-secondary teacher at the college level. That whole career pathway was because of career tech education. I'm currently in a career tech pathway in my career at this point. I would never have known about that had my school not offered career tech education. So I want to just take us back to Portland Public, where my kids go, as an example. They have dismantled the program. That opportunity isn't there. So I struggle with the thought of putting that at the school district level. And when we think about what it takes to get people through graduation, to me it's about relevancy and providing opportunities. And we've heard the dismantling, we've seen it, and I don't understand it, quite frankly. Third lowest graduation rate in the country is just unbelievable to all of us. And this is an opportunity to engage, to get kids engaged. And I've seen it, I've lived it, I've taught it, and I want it to be a part of our future. It's really important to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. It's a hot mic.
Yeah, you can even sit back. It's fine.
Hi, Senator Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Celeste Edmond. It's also my first time presenting to you, and I feel a little bit jittery about it. But I'm glad to be here, and thank you for having us. I am the CEO of Lunar Logic. We're a software company in Eugene, Oregon. We employ about 40 people. My husband also owns a startup firm in Eugene, Oregon that does restaurant software that employs six. So we're at almost 50 people between us. I also am on the STEM Investment Council, and I previously participated in the Small Business Advisory Cabinet with the governor last year. We are very involved in our community in Linn County. I'm personally in District 13. We have 16 school districts in our county, none of which teach a single computer programming class. We have 400 firms right now, technology in our county, 200 open jobs that we cannot fill. CTE was not something that I had any intent of being part of, I'm going to be completely honest. And I fell into selfishly, as some people have talked about, business. Yes, I do want to have people I can hire that come from Oregon. Half my staff did not graduate from college. They don't have a certificate. They didn't go to anything else. Several of our students we hired directly from the high schools. We have tried to solve this problem ourselves in our little county, in our little town. We went directly to the school districts and said, how do we work with you? How do we help? And initially, we were met with great resistance, and for good reason. We showed up and said, we want to have qualified employees. And the teacher said, we want to have students show up to our class. And we said, how do we help you? How do we bridge this gap? I'm not an educator, and I don't pretend to be. That's not what I'm here to talk to you about. But what I can tell you is that some of the things we've tried to do for ourselves have worked and have had significant results that have been in CTE. Hospitality is a huge industry in our county. With our university, track town, hospitality jobs are hard to fill. People don't see it as a track for themselves. That's part of career technical education. Healthcare positions that are not through OHSU, with all of the validity that comes through that, and certainly great respect to that, but in support roles, CNA and so on, are part of CTE, right? Restaurants, it's not just technology, and certainly the trades. All of my clients are longtime Oregon companies. We're talking about timber, commodities, manufacturing, businesses that can't hire anyone here because they don't have a qualified applicant. And we are volunteering. We're not asking for money from the state. We're showing up in classes and teaching and giving equipment. We're asking teachers, how do we co-teach with you? We paid for a whole district, a whole high school, my company did, to come to the downtown accelerator so we could train them on what it means to run a business. How do you apply the scientific method to schools? How do you cross-train? Can you have STEAM teams? What does it mean to be, now I'm not an educator, so I'm going to use all the wrong words, but to have the cross-content that we need? Because it's not enough in my company that you understand tech. You need to understand business value. You have to volunteer. You need to be doing smart reading through Rotary. You need to be in the schools showing up and doing Arduino teaching, the code chops that my employees volunteer for, which is a program funded through the community college. I have 8 employees that show up every Thursday night for the entire school year on their own time and teach students how to code. And we're doing that because we don't have the classes we need. It's not because we don't believe that we shouldn't put our money where our mouth is, because we are. Our time is there, our people are there, we're there. But we don't know how to connect the dots, and you do. And sometimes legislation is the only way to say, let's look at this. It's time to have some directed funding because this matters. And we're going to have a 25% gap in the ability to hire people in my industry alone. My industry that in Lane County passed timber, and we're one of the largest timber counties in the state, as you know, besides Douglas, of course, but that passed our wages and technology passed timber. The number of people that we employ passed timber. Think about that. And yet, if you're in timber, you also need to be a programmer. You also need to understand tech. If you're working for Bulk Handling Systems or Far West Steel, who are my clients, you have to understand technology. So this is a far-reaching thing, and I understand that the measure isn't perfect, and as you know, I mean, running a business, I don't understand all of the workings of the government, certainly. But what I do know is that I want to be able to hire Oregon kids in my companies. And I don't want to see my clients who have been in Oregon for 100 years have their businesses go away because they can't hire Oregon kids in their companies who didn't have to take on college debt, who can support a family on a family wage. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess the only question I have is that we have a dilemma that was mentioned. We have a little budget deficit right now. So the co-chairs have put, not the co-chairs, the governor actually put the amount for general education at about $8.1 billion. The schools say they need to do what they did last year, $8.4 billion. And if we take out the $300 million for this project, even at the best estimate with the governor's budget, we're going to be giving them $7.8 billion. So they're going to be way short of what they knew to do what they did last year. So that's the dilemma here. And if we follow this strictly and we don't, so I have a coding class that I just started last year, say, in my school, and they give me $7.8 billion. So I cut the last one I did, and the most expensive, which is what PPS did, what public did. They took out the most expensive so they can keep the class sizes down. So I cut out that course. I can't replace it because the money coming from the $300 million that I have for this bill, I have to spend on a new course. So I developed something new because even though coding was what my community needed, I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out. That's the dilemma that we see ourselves in, and that's the one I'm trying to figure out. How do we deal with this $300 million? And I'd love any thoughts you might have to help us do it, because I actually really believe in CTE, and our schools, when I was a principal, kept our programs at the, some people would say, the detriment of other programs. Our class size in elementary got a little bigger than I would love to have had them, but.
Well, first of all, let me say that I believe in fully funding education. You know, I see education as an investment in the future, unlike really the vast majority of things that exist in the budget. So that I would put that fully funded at the very top. So this, you know, if that happened, that would be a moot point. But in terms of how you prioritize, if it doesn't get fully funded, the real danger is that it moves out of CTE and goes into a kitty where there are decisions that are being made in districts, right, where the decision is cut CTE. And I don't know where the money is going, but I do know that we dropped from the fourth worst to the third worst in terms of graduation here in Oregon just this last year. And that, you know, we do great up until eighth grade, and then the kids fall off a cliff. So that obviously is where the money needs to be spent, in college counseling, you know, it is dropout prevention, and it's CTE. So those are the things that should be a priority. That's what 65% of the people who voted have said. And so it's really a matter of priorities.
Yes.
I'm going to get in trouble here, but you know, we're working on the revenue committee on a change in our revenue structure that ultimately, combined with cost cutting and pension reforms, will add more money, which will really make this problem go away. Probably would have prevented it in the first place, because there was no new money attached to that measure. And what you might see as a priority, educators say it's early reading. And when you're forced to make these kind of cuts to 7 point area, wherever they're, schools go into a necessary level of triage. And it's often the counselors in the CTE programs that do get cut. And so we're trying to achieve that level. I don't know what fully funding education means. You know, it means some different things to all of us. But at the end of the day, it starts with taxes and revenues. And so we're trying to find a fair way in the revenue committee. And I think you'll see something coming out next month on this. But for the businesses who do care about this, and I very much appreciate your engagement, especially from our technology sector. But we need your help with engagement on the other side, too. And right now we're getting beat up before the plan is even unveiled. And so there are two sides of this coin, and it doesn't do any good to argue which education, curriculum, or program is better if we can't pay for it, either one. So we need your engagement down the hall as well as in this room.
If I may add, I thank you for that. And certainly I see, and the number I saw on this was 141 million of the 300 was an initial pass for Measure 98, so it wasn't the full amount.
That was the governor.
That was the governor's, right, that came out.
There's other people who are pushing for it has to all be funded. So I mean, I'm just telling you.
Understood, yeah. Right. I mean, right, we run companies. So certainly we understand what it means to keep the ledger in the black, right? And investment sometimes in taking risk means that you take on debt. And in business, that's our personal risk. And it's not fair to ask taxpayers to take on the debt of a whole state. I get that too, certainly. In the way the law, this measure was written, it's not perfect. I agree with that. The issue I have with the amendment and my concern is that if we don't direct some of the funds specifically to CTE, that we may never come back to it. And that's a bit dramatic, but it is a fear that we have of how do we choose that. For me, it's really involving the community, companies like ours to help collaborate with this so that we start to change the funding model, that we don't depend on the state and taxpayers to be the only player in funding the schools, and do that in a way that doesn't become corporate. I don't put my brand on anything that we donate, but that we become part of that funding model and changing that, much like we've done in our county with entrepreneurship. But in terms of this amendment, that would be my concern, is to completely say, well, you don't have to direct any of it if you don't want to, is a concern, then it may never go there. Thank you.
Thank you.
So as a business representative, as a, you know, board member on the Portland Business Alliance, you know, I am happy to have any kind of conversation that you'd like to about revenue. The question really
volunteers
that's that's being directed, though, is what do you cut out of education? And my answer is you don't cut education at all. There is a broader budget that everybody should be looking at, and there is nothing that I can think of other than education that is so clearly an investment in our future. And if you look at high schools as well, if you look at this from the perspective of diversity, and tech has an incredible lack of diversity, right? What is the one institution in the state that every single person has the opportunity to attend? It's high school. It is the public education system. And sure, people can opt out of it, but that means, and especially if you prevent people from dropping out, that means 100% of Oregonians have the chance that is offered at these institutions, which is an incredibly rich opportunity that we cannot squander.
Okay.
Thank you.
The last thing I will say to that, as I am the chair, I get to say it, is that we have had a lot of initiatives since the 1990s which have spent our money. We have more prisons than we used to have. We have Measure 5 and 50. We have a lot of different things that have said, your main priority may be education, but you will fund public safety, and you will fund a number of things in our Constitution. So
Parks and fish.
I mean, it's there's a lot of stuff. So
came from voters, not from the legislature.
Yeah. Anyway, but thank you, and okay. I will talk to the Ways and Means people and have them come have you look at what we are spending it on and see where you can find that extra $300 million.
Chair,
that would be helpful. Yes.
If I could.
Okay.
You see them dropping out at eighth grade. A lot of those folks are lost in third grade. Okay. It's, you know, we've got to keep the system, you know, once they fall behind, if they aren't up to grade level, third grade, we lose them. They drop out at eighth grade because they're finally big enough to walk out. Okay, so you just, you know, it's the corpus of the system that needs to be protected. I'm not arguing against what you want. I'm just saying it's, you know, if we've lost a kid at third grade, CTE ain't going to get him back because he's already out. He's already gone.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daryl Fuller, David Ruffenfeld, Rosenfeld, I guess, and I'm trying to keep people together. Thomas McGregor, are you for, against, for? Against? I'll keep the other two then. I'll try to keep people together. So there's another one person, so you'll come up to the next and our last panel. Against, did you say? Come on up. This is the group. You're right. I was going wrong. Thank you. Whoever wants to start.
I'm in the building all the time, so if we're limited on time, I'd prefer the civilians get a chance to talk. But, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association. Given the hour, I'll be extremely brief. First of all, I'm a little disappointed that Senator Lithcom isn't here with his talk about calculus increasing his GPA. It took me 2 weeks of college calculus to become a political science major, and I never looked back. That's the truth. I've been in this building for 30 years, and I still get a little jittery up here, especially when I'm testifying in an education committee against something that Lori Wimmer wants. And so, but I do want to carefully disagree with my friend and colleague when she said that this was a top-down mandate. I believe this is the ultimate bottom-up mandate. It was the voters in all your districts who said, do this. It was the taxpayers in all your districts who said, do this. It was the parents in all of your districts who said, do this. How is that a top-down mandate when the people who pay the bills, when the people who bring their kids to schools, when the people who vote for you say, this is what we think we need? Now, are they absolutely right all the time? Of course not. But to have so many people come to this building and in this room and say the voters don't know what they're doing. The voters were wrong. The voters were confused. The voters don't know as much as we do. Well, those same voters elected you guys. And maybe, just maybe, they knew exactly what they were doing. And maybe, just maybe, you ought to give it a shot. And maybe 2 years from now you can come back and say, see, these parts didn't work, but maybe these parts didn't. But if you don't give the voters the basic respect of saying, we believe that you know what you're doing, we believe that you deliberately voted for this and against that, and we're going to do the best we can to have faith in the people who elected us, and we're going to give it a try, and then come back and fix what needs to be fixed, then I think we're doing a disservice to the system that we're in. Just real briefly on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association, we're repair shops. We have the same problem that the plumbers and that everybody else has. There's not enough people that are interested in these programs. There aren't enough programs. And there are a lot of school counselors that encourage really bright kids to go to college instead of go to the CTEC program. But you can't fix a car that's run by batteries or that's compressed natural gas. Or your average automobile now has more computing power than most of what NASA did in the 1960s. They need smart kids that understand math and computers to go into the CTEC programs, to go into the community college programs, to go into the apprenticeship programs. You just can't repair modern cars under the old, well, they're all grease monkeys, and so we'll let the kids that aren't qualified for college do these things. And so I would encourage you, and I understand you guys are in a dilemma, and I don't mean to disrespect that at all, but we do need to do it all. And with that, I'll cede my time, and thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Thomas McGregor. I'm the Chief Operations Officer of Phoenix Public Charter High School in Roseburg. We serve at-risk youth of the 10 communities of Douglas County. We are committed to helping every student succeed. Our mission is rigorous standards of academic success, including early college pipeline to Umpqua Community College, emphasis on career technical education skills, and personal growth for all of our students. I'm here to speak against Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 353. I believe the three strategies of Measure 98 have been our targets for program expansion. I remember sitting in a meeting with our leadership staff, must have been last August. These three targets were the targets we were talking about needing to expand. As a small school, I do wish to illuminate how Measure 98 formula dollars would make an enormous difference for us. First, our community college, our early college program, it currently uses AmeriCorps resources. Current administration in Washington, D.C. kind of makes me nervous about that. I would love to have a full-time staff working on that that's dedicated. We do not have, we also don't believe that, you know, getting our students into community college, that's not going to happen from UCC. That needs to happen with us. Youth are not acculturated to the community college processes. They don't understand a syllabus. They don't understand where to go on that campus. And it's our early college program that makes that happen. Recently, our leadership presented before the UCC board. And before then, we called up the registrar and asked, just curious, you know, how many of our students were on campus. We found out it was over more than 30. A couple years ago, we would have expected 2 to 3. The program is working, and we want to continue to support it. Measure $98 would directly result in the R-17-18 budget targeting expansion also for a GED program. As you know, No Child Left Behind made, especially a charter school like ours that takes students from all the other community districts and gives them a last resort, a last chance. Our report card doesn't look too good. And then No Child Left Behind world, that made us get rid of our GED program because that helped our report card. But now with Every Student Succeeds Act, we're bringing that GED program back because the local workforce demands it. We can get kids doing NCRC. We can get kids getting a GED. You know, even though they may have sat out on ninth grade and they probably won't get those 4 years of English and math and can't get that diploma, but we can get them doing CTE and into local jobs. Currently, Douglas County has a 65% rate dropout. These funds would, you know, also help us expand our advanced manufacturing program, expand our computer tech program, which, you know, we want to help, like, the businesses to the northern cities are also seeking. This would bring staff and equipment. And we feel that Measure 98 was crafted with this in mind, and we're ready to go to create this change. Finally, I'll say this because my leadership at the school wanted me to share this. Consider the backlash of 2 out of 3 voters in anti-tax Douglas County voted in favor for Measure 98. These business leaders, these parents understand that we have 1,000 unfilled jobs right now in Roseburg and Douglas County. It's quite phenomenal. And we seek prepared youth for our community workforce, and I urge you not to corrode support for their will here in Salem and support the vision of Measure 98. I thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Rosenfeld. I'm the campaign and field director for Stand for Children, Oregon. I was also the Measure 98 campaign manager. First thing is that what we're talking about here, there was a funding discussion, and we understand there's a funding discussion that has to have. I'm going to limit my remarks to the policy because I think that's what we're talking about here. The Measure 98 Coalition was a lot of different people. It included communities that have been working for decades on the ground, organizations working for decades on the ground with communities of color and low-income Oregonians. It included labor unions and the trades. You've heard from them. It included employers from almost every industry you can think of, and then included educators in the classroom, principals who run schools, school board members, and so forth. The process for creating Measure 98 included all of those Oregonians, and it took many years to put it together. It was based on the wisdom of people on the ground saying, what do we need to do to move the needle on graduation rates and career preparedness? And that was how the measure got crafted. It wasn't a shock to us that shortly after the election, our Chief Education Innovation Officer, Cole Gill, went on a listening tour around the state to go, hey, what should we do here? And the report back was a bunch of different things, all of which are great, including every single thing that's in Measure 98. We knew that, and we're glad that he did that. But just to say, these are not coincidences. This is all the wisdom of people on the ground, and that's what built it. And then, of course, as has been said, this was vetted then with over 2 million voters who 2-to-1 said we ought to do this. So this is, you know, a well-vetted idea. This is all just to say that there is reasons why Measure 98 was written the way it was, and it was all about just what are the precise things that you need to do in order to move the needle on graduation rates. So, for example, the requirement that the funds be spent in all three areas, every district, CTE, college prep and dropout prevention. That's because in the course of all of the work that went into it, we discovered that this stuff works like a tripod. And when you take a leg off the tripod, the thing falls over. So if you want to move the needle, you need to do all three. Now, some say, hey, a bunch of districts have maxed out on some of these, so shouldn't we provide more flexibility? There are very, very, very few districts in the state that have maxed out on any one of these things. There's oodles of opportunity. Students, most students in this state do not have the access to all three of these things in the way that they should, and so that was what went into this. So that's just an example of why. Now, you've heard other people who come at it from the CTE angle that are just worried that if you don't require CTE, it ain't going to happen, and that's a real concern too. But what I want to give you is also some of the underlying thinking of why it requires all three and why the dash one would take us backwards in that regard. Now, a piece of backstory on that that's really important to understand here, which is that when the crafters of Measure 98 went to Oregon ODE and asked, okay, what's the dollar amount that you need in order to be able to move the needle, and how should it get allocated? They came back and said about half of that, $800 per student, ought to go to CTE. So one thing that we've been asked is, well, hey, why didn't you write it that way? And we didn't precisely because of the deep respect that the crafters had and that the folks on the ground were saying of districts needing flexibility to spend the funds. This is a very, very important tradition in this state for all the good reasons that have been said here. And so it felt like a bridge too far to be that prescriptive. And so instead, the measure was written to say, you got to spend it in all three because we know that you got to do in order to move the needle. But we'll let you decide how to allocate those funds among that. We'll let you decide what CTE to invest in, what college prep to invest in, what dropout prevention to invest in. And we'll even say that the whole expansion idea is really flexible, too. In contrast to, I think, what was said earlier, expansion could mean just adding a section to an automotive shop class that you have already. You don't have to create an entirely new thing. You build on top of what it is that you have. But we have to expand if we're going to give more students access to all of these things. Otherwise, what are we doing that doesn't move the needle at all? And so that was just by way of background why that particular thing was written as it was and why the dash one would be a real step backwards in doing that. And as for the scenario for, hey, a district will put $1 in and $1 in and then all the rest of the money that way, that's an unlikely scenario, I would say, and especially given what the voters intended, there would be, you know, that just seems very implausible, just given what the voter intent is. So that's mostly what I wanted to say about all of that. And there's obviously more that we can get into about why the other particular provisions of the dash one would be problematic and a step backwards too. But I think that that's just the most important thing. And then, you know, just finally, I'll just reiterate that there's very few policies I've seen that have been this vetted. And so what we've heard before about, how, you know, this whole top-down thing just doesn't really resonate when you take a look. And this is a real opportunity for us to do right. And we recognize that there are funding challenges. That's real. We've got to work through that stuff. But as far as the policy, like once a dollar is put in, whether it's a dollar or $300 million, how it ought to get directed, we are imploring you that to just consider what went into developing the measure, why those are the reasons why they're doing it. And as Daryl said, let's see how that works. Let's give that a roll and let's see if we can move the needle here for our students. Thank you.
So one question. If we give you the money from Measure 98 and we take away, because your basic school funding, a little bit more than that, how do you expand?
The way we expand is because we'll be able to reach more students. I'm a charter school.
You have less money, though, than you had last year.
I understand. Okay. But with more opportunities, I can have more students in my door, more programming, GED program. I'm not reaching those students right now.
Okay. And the other question is, in the Measure 98, why no funding?
There's a premise in Measure 98. Chair Roveland, members of the committee, there is funding in there. The premise is that the state is collecting $1.5 billion or so more dollars than they were in the previous biennium as a result of a growing economy and a growing population, and that a portion, as long as those revenues are $1.5 billion or more, a portion of that, $300 million, could be invested in Measure 98.
Any other questions? Thank you. And Jody Weiser, you get to clean up. You're our last person on the list. Yeah, thanks. And thank you all for staying and being here.
Yes. For the record, Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon. Such a large panel left. I think you've had wonderful discussion, and I want to just make 3 points from the testimony that's prepared for us. About half of my steering committee is made up of professional educators, mostly all of us retired. And so this has been an issue that has mattered to us a great deal. What we like about the Dash One is that it removes an extraordinary number of musts, shalls, and may nots from the bill, and instead revises the language itself, shows respect for the professional knowledge and experiences in the local context, and we think that's very important. It also actually supports more successful implementation and potentially would lead to better outcomes because it has the fact that if you have in your community somebody who's really pushing you in one direction because they're offering resources, you could be responsive to that instead of expanding the what you're doing in terms of college classes for kids when there's not even a college that's close by for you to work with, possibly. And the third thing is that we don't know what's going to happen in the future, and the current language in the bill ties us into stuff very tightly, that the future may take us in all sorts of directions. I mean, coding wasn't an option when I was in high school. It was sewing machines and hammers, you know? And certainly I didn't see a 3D printer in my experience. So I think that it's important to leave that kind of flexibility. I think the funding question is the big question before us. And the Dash One gives us some flexibility about that as well. So it's a big job you have. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we went over a little bit. I appreciate people staying, all of us. And with that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 353. And I don't think there's anything more, so we're going to...
We can't pass anything,
that's
so
right.
What the heck?
That's right. We'll close our Senate Education Committee today on the 6th. Thank you all. Thank you all. Today on the 6th.